You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hey, Pantheon listeners, Christian Swain here, taking a break from listening to a little Shout It Out Loudcast episode. Love Tom and Zeus talking all things KISS. Of course, I was listening to them on my new Raycon wireless earbuds. They have quickly become my go-to earbuds because of the comfort. These soft tips are the best I've ever used. And at this price, plus a Pantheon discount, Raycon is really hitting on all marks. Sound quality is great too. I really love having these three EQ options because I like more bass in the music, but less in my podcast. 8 hours of playtime for the battery is great as well. Surround sound, noise isolating, and awareness mode are all included. These are great earbuds. Go to buyraycon.com/pantheon today to get 20% off your Raycon order plus free shipping. That's right. You'll get 20% off and free shipping at buyraycon.com/pantheon. buyraycon.com/pantheon.
Hello and welcome to Vintage Rock Pod, the ultimate classic rock podcast, with a new episode released every single day. I'm Paul Stevenson, thanks as always for hitting play. Now this week's episode is Volume 6 of the Great Rock Stories series. The first five have all been really well received, and it's a great way for especially new listeners to get a snapshot of what Vintage Rock Pod is all about. I've had so many great guests on the show over the last, nearly 3 years now, and I know not everyone listening right now has probably checked out every single one, and that's okay. So this is a nice way to not only highlight the older interviews, but also maybe open some eyes or ears to a new audience too. Now, if you're not listening to this on the Vintage Rock Pod channel, then please do go to Vintage Rock Pod and give us a follow, subscribe, or like, or whatever it's called on your podcast app, because I release a new episode every single day, and you can only get all those episodes on the Vintage Rock Pod feed, so please do check it out and get all the brilliant classic rock content daily. So on this episode, we're going to dive back to episodes 38 to 43. That was back in September and October of 2021. I've picked out some fun stories from those interviews, talking about some big hits, time in a Rock and Roll Hall of Fame group, working with Rod Stewart, crazy publicity stunt, recording in a Beatles home, and much more. But we're going to start with episode 43 and legendary drummer Carmine Appice, one of my favourite guests, so much so that I've had him on Vintage Rock Pod twice over the years, and I still haven't got to the bottom of all his stories. Anyway, we're going to start by hearing him talk about his time in Vanilla Fudge and the song that made them a household name. Their version of the song, You Keep Me Hanging On. What was it about that sound and that you guys loved so much then? And what was the process that you went through when you're in recording some of these songs?
Well, it really started from the Rascals, you know. The Rascals were a New York band that got really famous, and they did some do-over songs like Midnight Hour and Mustang Sally and stuff like that. And then there was a fad that was going around in Long Island with Leslie West was in a group called the Vagrants. And Billy Joel was in a group called the Hassles. And we used to all do rearrangements. That was the fad in Long Island. And the Vagrants were the biggest. They used to draw 2,000 people to my manager's club, you know? Mm-hmm. And that's what, when the Pigeons asked me to join them, that's what they wanted to do. This new fad music. That all the arrangements were original. Mm-hmm. But the songs were famous songs, and we would redo all the songs and like rearrange them totally.
Yeah.
What our concept was to match the music and the emotion of the lyrics together. like "You Keep Me Hanging On," and Lucinelli was "Set Me Free, Why Don't You, Babe?" It was like a happy song, but really not happy lyrics. And so we married the emotional music to the emotional lyric with emotional vocals. And that's what happened there. You know, it was great. Between that and the fact that we had four voices and we picked the correct songs and we married the songs to the music. Eleanor Rigby, I mean, the Beatles did it amazing with the quartet, but we took it and put it into an eerie setting, almost like an eerie soundtrack to the lyrics.
Yeah.
Would You Keep Me Hanging On? We went in, recorded, and one take mono, everything once. I always say that 7 minutes have changed my life.
And while I had him on, I had to ask him about joining Rod Stewart in the 80s. Carmine was part of Rod's band and got co-writer credits on many of his big hits at that time, including Do You Think I'm Sexy? So here he is talking about his time with Rod.
It was by accident. One day I'm walking in L.A. after all that, and I ran into my friend Sandy Gennaro, drummer. I said, "Hey, Sandy, how are you doing?" And he said, "Good." I said, "What are you doing?" He goes, "I just auditioned for Rod. I didn't make it. You should call him." I said, "Really? Who'd you call?" So he showed me the guy's name, Pete Buckland. I said, "Oh, Pete, we did 35 gigs with Faces and Cactus. We used to wreck hotel rooms and abuse women and did everything, wreck cars and did everything together. And Pete was at the helm of it all." So I said, "Oh, give me the number." So I called Pete and I said, "Hey, Pete, it's Carmine and Peace. What's the deal? Rod's looking for a drummer. You don't call me?" And he says, "Oh, you're always busy." I said, "Well, I'm not busy now. I'd love to play with Rod." "You know, let me call Rod. He's in England." So he called Rod, and Rod told him, "Have Carmine go to my house. The band is there. Have him, me, check it out." So it was almost like, "Have Carmine check the band out. See if he likes it." I said, "Whoa, that's a switch." And I said, "I know Rod now. You know, this was, I've known Rod since 68, and this is like almost 10 years later, you know? And we did a lot of gigs together with Cactus and Faces and all." Yeah. So I went to the house. I figured, well, I'm going to Rod Stewart's, so I'm going to bring a good car. So I had a Pantera at the time, which is now in England. A guy bought it in England, and he's redoing this Pantera, totally restoring it for car shows. Nice. And since I had that car for 40 years, he's going to call it the Carmine the Peace Pantera. And I'm going to tell him about all the people that rode in it, like Ozzy and Rod Stewart and Prince and all these different people, wow. Jeff Beck, you know. Anyway, so I drove the Pantera to Rod's house. I pull up to these gigantic gates. I said, "Whoa, I didn't know Rod was this successful," you know. And I pull in, and then I go in and I see Phil Chen. I go, "Hey, I didn't know you were in the band." And I meet Jim Cregan. He was in the band. I met him in England. And so we had a play. It sounded good. And also, yeah, I had to have this in my head. As soon as I went in there, I saw the mansion. I saw, you know, Porsches and Lamborghinis and all these cars. And I said, "I want to play here. I want to play with this band." You know?
The brilliant Carmine Appice there. So many crazy stories, like a fight with Black Sabbath and touring the US with Led Zeppelin as their support act and all the stuff around that. Being fired from Ozzy's band in the 80s by Sharon Osbourne and the crazy stuff she did to force him out and so much more. Check it out in full on episode 43. It's a great one. Right, next up, let's hear about a classic rock anthem, Slow Ride. It's still a favourite, what, nearly 50 years on. It still gets played on classic rock radio. It's a real fan's favourite. I spoke with Foghat legend, another drummer, Roger Earl, on episode 38. And here we talk about the song.
You're talking about the success in America then. I mean, what was it, 8 gold albums, a platinum album, a double platinum album? It was just phenomenal, the success you had over there. The big one, your first one that went platinum was Fool for the City. And we'd like to touch on that one from 1975. And we've got to talk about the big single that came off that album as well. We hate to hear about these big hits and things like that now. Some people I speak to tell me that the big hits, they knew it was going to be a hit from the second they wrote it. Some people tell me it was an album filler. They didn't expect it to go as big as it did. So Slow Ride, I mean, the first time you heard it, played it, recorded it, what was your feelings about the song?
Yeah, it was the first time we recorded it. Rod Price and I, who was our lead and slide guitar player at the time, owned a house down here on Long Island, and we were like the old couple. We'd soundproof the basement, and Nick Jameson had just joined the band on bass. And the first song we started, a lot of our songs came from just jamming, you know, I'd just start playing and everybody join in, or vice versa. And basically, Slow Ride comes from it's a John Lee Hooker riff. Instead of playing it like a shuffle, it's played like in a straight 4/4, you know, instead of like a shuffle. So we actually did the whole arrangement to the song, you know, like the drum and bass breakdown in the middle. And after we've been doing this, Dave said, I think I've got some words that will fit to that. And that's how it happened. Nick Jameson and I were finishing mixing the Fall for the City album. Nick did all the mixing. I'd bring in tea and biscuits. and we finished mixing it, and the B-side was Save Your Lovin'. That was off the same album. And we took it back down to Bearsville Records and played it for the head honcho there, Paul Fishkin. And he said, because it was Nick and I decided it was a single, going back to what you asked. It was, yep. Actually, it was the first time that I ever thought of a single. And Paul said, well, that can't be a single. It's nearly 8 minutes long. We said, to you, not to you, to Paul. And he said, well, you can't put a 7-minute song out. And we said, yes, we can. We can do whatever we want. So it did go out initially as a 7-minute song, but then reality struck home, and the radio stations were editing it themselves. So we figured it'd be better if we just got Nick Jameson to edit it, and he brought it down to about 4 minutes. But yeah, that was John Lee Hooker riff. Yeah, it was a big hit for us.
An incredible longevity behind it as well, because it stuck around forever, and it's got so many different generations that know it from different things. I mean, I've got an 8-year-old son who he's got his own little Spotify account, and he's always listening to all these weird and random things. He had he hooks up to the car while we're driving. He had a Traffic song on. I'm thinking, that's 60s. Where's he got this from? And then Slow Ride came on. And he sat there humming away to it, and I'm thinking, where was it, 8-year-old? And it's just incredible. That song just seems to bridge all the generations.
You know, I think you know, the late 60s, maybe I'm biased because that was like, you know, when I really started, you know, learning my craft, learning my trade, but like, you know, doing it. It was a great time to be involved in music. Maybe we're biased, but I was glad I was born when I was born. You know what I'm saying? I used to go to the Marquee Thursday nights to see who was that? Well, the Stones would play there, the Yardbirds, of course. Yeah, it was a great time. Actually, I remember one time Mick spilled a beer on me. A brush with greatness. Eel Pie Island, he turned around and bumped into me and spilled his beer on me. And he said, oh, sorry, mate. I said, that's okay.
As soon as it was you, yeah. Absolutely.
I love the Stones. They're a great band.
Absolutely. Absolutely fantastic.
Roger Earl there. Again, another top interview. He tells a great story about auditioning for Jimi Hendrix. And you can hear that on the full interview on episode 38. Check it out now. Next up, let's hear from a Rock and Roll Hall of Famer now, Dave Mason. He achieved success originally in the band Traffic, along with Steve Winwood and Jim Capaldi, and was inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame with them as well. But then he found solo success in North America in the years that followed that too. Now in this clip, we're going to hear us chat about the Traffic days and the early years.
Traffic, I mean, you were just a teenager when the band got together, and you're writing big hits, Hole in My Shoe and Feeling All Right and that sort of stuff. I mean, that's pretty incredible, really, isn't it, for anybody?
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, I just was the right place, the right time, whatever. I mean, it was just fortuitous that Jim and I met up with Winwood, and that band just happened just out of basically just, you know, guys just hanging out, listening to music a lot when we could. And it just developed into Traffic.
So how did all that happen then? How did you guys meet? Because the end of the 60s in the UK was rocking time, wasn't it? You think of the bands that were coming through at the time and the music that was being played. So how did you all get together?
Hey, Pantheon listeners, Christian Swain here. Another day, another podcast I'm working on. This time, it's Famous and Gravy with Amit and Michael. I want to let you know that I loved the Factor Meals package so much that I re-upped for myself. And then I sent a package to my in-laws. Like I was with my first shipment from Factor Meals, the in-laws were as excited to try one of the prepared restaurant quality meals. Well, they got the shipment to Protein Plus Meal Plan and were very impressed. See, being in their 80s, anything to make the meal prep easy is a plus for them. They heated the oven per instructions and minutes later were enjoying a very delicious, nutritious, and dietitian-approved meal. One big win for me. But what really floored them was the taste. Like I told you, it's surprising how good these meals taste. Restaurant quality indeed. And like my own shipment, it really was everything Factor Meals said it would be for some seniors. No prep, no mess meals. Factor Meals are 100% ready to heat and eat. Take it from me and my in-laws. Head to factormeals.com/pantheon50 and use the code Pantheon50 to get 50% off. That's factormeals.com/pantheon50 and use the code Pantheon50 to get 50% off. Thank you, Factor Meals.
Hey folks, Stefan Shirazi and Renee Richardson here from the Metallica Report.
And we are proud members of the Pantheon podcast family, where the best of music and podcasts unite.
We've got something pretty cool for you. We're giving away an exclusive Metallica merch package worth over $250.
That's a whole lot of scary guys, skulls, M72, and other sought-after Metallica swag. And we've made it easy for you to win. Follow and share the Metallica Report, and you're in the game. Go to pantheonpodcast.com/Metallica, enter your email, and hit that button to be entered to win.
And just like that, you're eligible for our monthly exclusive Metallica merch package.
And guess what, rockers? You can enter every month, so just do it. And while we love our global brothers and sisters, the lawyers won't let us ship outside the U.S.
We met in a place called the Elbow Room in Birmingham, basically, an after-hours club. A lot of bands would go there, but that's how we met. Just developed from there. And like I said, just four guys hanging out.
Four young guys hanging out, indeed. And then, like we said, I think one of the first songs that you wrote was Hole in My Shoe, which was a big hit over here in the UK. Got to number two, didn't it?
Yes. Yes, it did. It got to number two. Engelbert Humperdinck kept me from number one. And it was the first song I'd ever written. It was, 19? Very naive in a way. It was Song of the Times, and I was playing sitar. That influence was coming into music a lot. I don't know if it was exactly what everybody wanted to play, but the fact of the matter was it was a hit record. So
absolutely,
it drew everybody's attention to what Traffic was doing otherwise. I mean, there's very varied tastes in that band, which was probably to me its strength, but it's what pulled it apart in the end.
Yeah, and you mentioned there, I mean, pulling it apart. You left, didn't you, after the first album first came out, Mr. Fantasy, which was a big hit again. I mean, top 20 in the UK, the album itself. It was a hit in America as well.
Yeah, I left. I left because I was just too young. So young, and the success was, just for me, it was, I'm from Worcester. Yeah. I'm just, you know, running around in farmland. So it was all a little bit too much for me at the time, at that age. I left.
You did rejoin, didn't you, in time for the second album, and you contributed a whole host of songs. And again, the big song, Feeling All Right, was on there. And that's the one that kind of everyone remembers. It was a big hit, and Joe Cocker's obviously since taken it on and things like that. But can you remember much about the sessions or the writing of Feeling All Right?
Well, I had written that song during the period of time that I was not with Traffic. I actually wrote it on an island called Hydra in Greece. It's just a it's a unrequited love song, basically.
And what did you make of Joe Cocker? I mean, did you get a chance to perform with Joe Cocker when he did it?
Oh yeah, sure. I've done it a few times with Joe. Yeah. Did it a couple of times with John Belushi doing Joe.
Was that more fun?
With Belushi? Yeah. Of course.
That's another brilliant interview to check out. He tells a great story of his friendship with Jimi Hendrix and how he came to play on the studio recordings of Jimi's big hits, All Along the Watchtower and Crosstown Traffic. Give a listen to the interview in full on episode 42 of Vintage Rock Pod. Now, since we've done a bit of 60s and 70s chat, let's bounce into the 80s with British favourites Marillion. They hit big in the 80s with the album Misplaced Childhood and a conquering single, Kaylee. Now, I spoke with the band's guitarist, Steve Rothery, on episode 41, and we talked about that success and how the band dealt with their charismatic lead singer, Fish, leaving the group.
Misplaced Childhood, which went on to become a UK number one album. I mean, that's phenomenal. It also went big around the world as well. You got some big hits off that and you were charting around the place. I mean, We talked about being young and wanting to become professional musicians, but at this point, your dreams are coming true. I mean, like I said, Top of the Pops, hit records, playing the world, supporting Queen in front of over 150,000 people. I mean, yeah. Wow, as someone that could only dream of that, how does that feel at that time?
Incredibly surreal. I remember we did a gig in France, and we flew back by Learjet to do Top of the Pops because Kayleigh had gone back up. Climbed higher in the charts, and yeah, you just, nothing prepares you for that, really. You know, you feel like you're in Duran Duran or something. Of course, you know, it's not really what we're about, so it didn't last. But having said that, I think the impact that Kayleigh made and then Misplaced Childhood made is probably one of the reasons that the band's still going, because when you do get that mainstream exposure, it stays with people for a long time.
Absolutely. And more mainstream exposures are always going to follow, like Clutching at Straws, reached number two, another big hit on there as well, Incommunicado. And then the parting of the ways with Fish as well during the work on the next album. What was your thoughts amongst the band, yourself and the other members, at that point when Fish left?
Well, I think we just wanted to carry on. We had a lot of confidence in the music that we'd written. There were some very strong musical ideas that surfaced on Season's End and Holidays in Eden. Mm-hmm. So there was no question of stopping. We just thought we'd have to find someone. You know, obviously, you can't just replace someone like Fish. He was too important part of the band. But just to try and find someone you can have a strong musical chemistry with and who understood the sort of thing that you were trying to do. You know, we auditioned about, I don't know, 50 people. And they were either kind of like wanting to be Fish or they were just from a more straightforward kind of rock area. So just not at all suitable. But when we heard Steve Hogarth's tape of a couple of How We Live songs, you know, we thought immediately, here's someone working in a similar kind of area musically, but with a really interesting and distinctive voice.
So you say they're hearing Steve's audition tape. I mean, how did that come about? Did he hear that you were looking for, well, he obviously knew that you were looking for a lead singer. Was he just getting in touch and putting himself out there?
No, it was actually his publisher who sent the tape to John Arneson, our manager. And John played it and thought it was interesting. So he brought it up to us. And yeah, we were very excited to meet Steve, and that we kind of got him down. And it went incredibly well. But he didn't jump at the chance. He was just about to turn his back on the music business and be a milkman, I think, or a postman. but he'd also just had the offer to, because he just played on an album piano and an album by the and he'd had just had an offer to go and play keyboards with him on tour, which he was thinking about. So, it took him a few days to decide, but. Fortunately for all of us, he made the wise choice.
Absolutely. A good decision in the end. And the band just kept excelling from there. The next three albums with Steve all went top 10 as well. And the famed Marillion fans, you've got such a strong and loyal fan base. They're all still enjoying what you're putting out and creating as a band. I mean, that must have felt good knowing that obviously such a big character had left the band and Steve had come in and the fans are still behind you and supporting everything you do.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we have the best fan base of any band in the world. You know, obviously, when you have a major change like that, you do have to rebuild the trust to a certain amount. But I think we did that with Season's End. And the response live was always fantastic with Steve for that, the first tour. And we proved to our audience that this was still something special.
Steve Rothery from Marillion there. The full interview is on episode 41. Now, next up, we're going to hear from another Rock and Roll Hall of Famer, this time Bev Bevan. He was inducted into the Rock Hall with the band ELO, but he also worked with Black Sabbath, and before all that was with The Move, who had some big hits in the UK in the 60s, including number one single Blackberry Way, and their track Flowers in the Rain was the first ever song played on Radio 1 as well. Now I'm going to play you a couple of clips from that interview, and the first one, he talks about the crazy publicity stunts the band used to get up to when they were in The Move.
and you mentioned the manager there. I mean, Tony Secundo, he was one for the extraordinary, wasn't he? He liked his publicity stunts, didn't he? And one of the famous story of you having to give up all the royalties to Flowers in the Rain because of a stunt that he pulled off.
Yeah, he managed to upset Harold Wilson, the Prime Minister. by issuing a postcard that was obviously libelous, and it went to court, and we lost the case, unsurprisingly. And to this day, we've never had any royalties for Flowers in the Rain or the B-side, Here We Go Around the Lemon Tree. And most unfairly is that my still good friend, I like to add, Roy Wood, he wrote both those songs, and he's never had any songwriting royalties, which is very unfair.
And was that something that you guys as the band enjoyed, doing these kind of crazy publicity stunts? Because I think at one point you signed your contract on the back of a topless model as well, and all that sort of crazy stuff was going on, being paraded around the streets and stuff. I mean, did you guys enjoy that, or was that completely out of your comfort zone?
Some of us enjoyed it more than others. I mean, we carried a replica H-bomb through the streets of Manchester for all afternoon, and we were trying to get arrested. It was just absurd. And the police eventually just moved us on. But, you know, we made out that we'd been arrested and everything. And they were crazy stunts. But some of them, were fun, sure. And the more rebellious ones amongst us. I mean, Roy was always a very shy sort of person, really, and he hated all that stuff.
And moving on to his time in Electric Light Orchestra, we spoke about the incredible success that band achieved.
Between 72 and 86, you had more top 40 hits in the UK and US than any other band on the planet. I mean, that's just staggering to think of. And it was kind of the album El Dorado, wasn't it, that pushed you firstly into that huge stratospheric point, especially in America.
Absolutely. The one thing where the move went wrong is that we never went to America. Mm-hmm. We did in 1969, like a 3-week tour, but we were way past our best. We should have gone, in 67, like the Who did, and Hendrix went back there, and Cream. And I think we'd have done well, but anyway, that we'll never know that. So we made a point of concentrating on America, and you're absolutely right. The first gold album was El Dorado, which wasn't a hit in the UK. And our first major hit in America was a great Jeff Lynne song called Can't Get It Out of My Head, which again was not a hit in the UK. But Jeff just got better and better, really, as a songwriter and producer. And it, as you've just said, it was pretty staggering list of hits there.
And you mentioned Jeff getting better and better in there. When you look at the records that you guys put out, I mean, Face the Music followed, A New World Record, that sort of thing, you're finding yourselves as one of the biggest bands on the planet. Did Jeff have any pressure, or did he struggle with writing stuff like that, or did it just come quite naturally to him?
I think he was definitely under pressure to write new songs and new albums. And we based ourselves in Musicland Studios in Munich, which Queen later used, and it was Donna Summer's studio too. And we just spent weeks and weeks there. But Jeff loved recording. And out of the blue, that was a follow-up to New World Record, I think. Yeah. And the idea, as far as I know, we were just going to make another album. But Jeff just couldn't stop writing great songs. and it ended up a double album and probably the best album that we ever made.
That's another top interview. Look out for it on episode 40. That is Bev Bevan. And last but not least on today's Great Rock Stories is my interview with current Styx star Lawrence Gowan. Larry's been with the band since the 90s, but before that he had huge success in his homeland of Canada. And in this clip we talk about that success and how he recorded his breakthrough album with a Beatle overseeing the action.
Let's start with Gowan, with your stuff, your solo stuff, because you had success in the 80s and in the 90s with your own work. And the breakthrough album, the big one that kind of burst you onto the stage, Strange Animal, in 1985, that has a British connection as well, doesn't it?
Very much so, because two of my albums were recorded entirely in England. And Strange Animal was recorded at Tittenhurst Park in Ascot. And people might recognize that name. It was it's the house where Ringo Starr was living in the 80s. We recorded there in 1984. The album came out in 85. And prior to that, the previous owner to Ringo Starr was one of his bandmates, John Lennon, who recorded Imagine in that studio. So it was a phenomenal life experience for me, because the Beatles were the reason that I wanted to be a musician, like millions of musicians around the world today. I remember seeing them at the age of seven. You know, I saw them on, there was a show, a variety show here in America called the Ed Sullivan Show. And they came on there. And at about 7 years of age, I realized maybe I don't have to be a hockey player after all. There might be another pursuit in life. And so to meet him pretty much 20 years, almost to the day, it was in February 7th, 1984. And to make the album there was fantastic. Ringo was living there at the time, and he would occasionally pop into the studio and make some really fantastic, encouraging comments as we were making the record. And then Strange Animal, it's funny, when we finished recording Strange Animal, an excellent producer, just the right guy at the right time, a guy named Dave Tickle, and the band was Peter Gabriel's backing band with Tony Levin and Jared Murata, David Rhodes, and another fellow by the name of Chris Jarrett, played with Annabelle Lamb. And so the five of us made the album, and I did go back to Canada with a pretty good sense of confidence that someone's going to like this record. It wound up going triple platinum in Canada, but I was on Columbia Records, on CBS Records, but it never really had a proper release in the United States. And so I kind of remained a bit of an enigma to a good number of people in the U.S. for a number of years. But now I've been here. I'm in Phoenix today, touring with Styx for the last 22 years, as you mentioned. And that pretty well sums up my life from beginning to the present.
Touching on that quickly, then, I spoke to Lee Aaron not too long ago as well, and she obviously had huge success in Canada. She's Canadian, obviously, and she had a bit of success in Europe as well. But because of record company, this, that, and the others, she never got the break in America. Is that kind of what happened with you?
Well, the way that it used to work, right, we're in a completely different universe now in the music business side of things, because you and I, right now, we have a worldwide release of this little Zoom call that we're doing, right? It goes everywhere.
Yep.
But the way that the music industry, the way they built that industry, a good part of it, they were smart business people. They had complete control of the market as to who got exposed into what market and why. So, for example, I remember going to England in the 80s, and The Jam were a phenomenal band, a huge band. And I think you were playing Wembley and stuff. And I come back, and in America, even if I crossed the border, very few people knew who they were. And I thought, this is really odd. And then I began to realize this is part of how the record companies, the four majors, really controlled the market. And as Canadians, it was very difficult. You needed a really unique, lucky break to suddenly find a path into the United States. And although we share a border. So that's just the way it was back then. And I have very few complaints, though, because things worked out.
The lovely Lawrence Gowan there. A real fun interview, that one. Please do check it out in full on episode 38 of Vintage Rock Pod. But that's it for Great Rock Stories Volume 6 then. I really hope you enjoyed all those little tastes of the back catalogue. Please check out those older interviews in full. But don't just stop there as well. If you're a newer listener, then please do go right back. I know it's a long way to scroll, seeing as though I put out episodes every single day, but there are some fantastic ones. Like I said, over 20 Rock and Roll Hall of Famers have been interviewed throughout the years on Vintage Rock Pod, so please do check them out. Also, please check out the Vintage Rock Pod YouTube channel. It's growing all the time. Some nice little bits on there that are very much different to the podcast as well, which includes a daily poll. I put that out and it attracts thousands of votes every single day. Loads of great discussion surrounds those too, so please do not miss it. It's definitely worth subscribing, and you get to see the interviews that I do with all these legendary people as well on the videos that I put up on the Vintage Rock Pod channel on YouTube. So please do hit the subscribe button, activate the bell on there so you don't miss any. It is all absolutely free, won't cost you a penny, so please do show your support that way. Well, that's it for me on the big show this week. Then I'll be back tomorrow with another This Day Rocks episode. So until then, take care.
Hey, this is Liberty DeVito.
This is Mike Del Judas.
This is Michael Cavanaugh from Broadway's Moving Out.
This is John Jackson, director of the Billy Joel Archive.
This is Russell Javers.
This is Richie Cannata, and you're listening to Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast. It's awesome.
I'm Michael Grosvenor.
And I'm Jack Fernino.
We're lifelong Billy Joel fans who launched a podcast in 2020 celebrating the music we love.
Whether you're looking for the greatest hits or the B-sides and rarities, you'll find it all here. And if you've ever wondered what happens behind the scenes of a concert or recording session, we've got you covered.
Join us as we explore albums, tours, band members, the latest news, and more. You'll also get a unique glimpse into the music industry straight from the musicians and other professionals who help make it all happen.
Tune into Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast at glasshousespod.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast is a proud member of the Pantheon Podcasts Network.